The games and the people who sold them were at war with each other. Both sides were led by equally talented management partners and staffed with strong people. Before I arrived, the trenches had been dug deep. Frustrated by the vagaries of the creative process, the sales side blamed the creative side for failing to deliver on time and for not producing the games the market desired. The creative people blamed the salespeople for wanting only Me Too titles, for not being able to effectively sell potential hits, and for goading them into foolishly aggressive development schedules. As summer ended, I could see that we had an unworkable plan and an internecine war, but the prospect of failure never occurred to me. As colleagues warned that the sky was falling, I quickly reassured them that we would be fine, that I had seen worse, much worse. In truth, I understood the company's most basic problem and knew what to do about it. In its initial zeal to become a major player, Crystal had tried to instantly become a full-service developer and publisher with its own sales and distribution resources, even before it had produced a reliable pipeline of successful products. A sales force requires a steady flow of marketable titles to sustain itself, and Crystal wasn't capable of delivering them yet. Crystal had tried to do too much, too fast. My instincts, reinforced by my experience at LucasArts, said we should take a step backward and do this right. Cut back the sales side of the business and retreat to the core of the company, the creative organization. Focus all our resources on developing a small number of high-quality games. Sell these games through outside publishers. Then, when we had a stable of successful titles, rebuild Crystal's own sales organization and recapture the control and margin given up to the distribution partners. We would likely wind up in the same place sought by the founders, but by a different route and with less risk at each step. Naturally, the prospect of pulling back from the plan did not excite the board. The success of the roadshow was still a vivid memory, and hope among many of the board members of achieving the original dream, quickly becoming a dominant, publicly traded, full-service developer and publisher of next-generation games, remained high despite management's growing doubts. Instead of pressing for what I believed, in the face of their resistance, I offered two alternatives. Scale up by acquiring other companies and creative teams, or sell out. If Crystal Dynamics could find a company that would value our people, our products, and our early position in the market, we could avoid layoffs and still give the investors a good return. Moreover, I would be free of my dilemma. For the next few months, we considered candidates for purchase and held discussions with a number of them, but we never found an acquisition that made sense. At the same time, through that winter, we looked high and low for another company to acquire us. We held serious discussions with more than one potential buyer, but those came to nothing and only confirmed my worst fears. As the game business consolidated, the buyers preferred companies with far more revenue and better established products than we had. The board's reaction to my alternatives also proved to be divided. A majority opposed selling because their hearts remained set on building a successful independent company. There was no consensus either that we should grow by acquisition, even if we could find good candidates, because of the inevitable dilution to the investors. In something of a precursor to the internet premature IPO phenomenon, some board members even suggested going public, but I couldn't see how that would solve our operating problems and refused to support it. We needed to get our house in order first. January and February came and went, and we were still trapped by disagreement and indecision. So began my sleepless nights. They were not sleepless because of the business problems, serious as those were. I had faced worse in other companies without losing sleep. But because I began to recognize a fundamental flaw in my relationship with the company. If I understood the problem and the solution, why didn't I act on it? Why didn't I shut down the sales organization? I had stood up to resistant board members on other issues. Why not now, on the most important issue of all? Resolution for me and for the company did not come until May, a year after I joined Crystal. That month, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, the industry's annual trade show, known as E3, was held in Los Angeles. Hollywood had become enamored with the game business, and they were going to up the ante with their star power and cachet. What did not bode well for Crystal was obvious as I surveyed the exhibit hall. Several game publishers, glitzed out with dancing showgirls, pin-up signing autographs, and huge screens featuring the latest releases, dwarfed my little company. We had puffed up to look like a substantial player for the show, but we seemed puny by comparison. And we were running out of time. One evening, I cruised the industry parties with Tony, a friend of mine. A very bright and exotic woman, part French, part American Indian, with a strong aesthetic sense. Tony had co-founded a game company that made cool avant-garde games for the PC. Her titles weren't bestsellers, but they were beautiful and innovative, and, not surprisingly, she was not a fan of Crystal's shoot-em-ups and fantasy play. As we whizzed along the freeway in a limo, each of us half-drunk, she turned to me rather suddenly. "What are you doing in the game business?" The way she said it was, "the game business." "What are you doing in the game business?" Taking her challenge, I sobered up enough to launch into my grand vision speech. We're at an early stage, but it's the dawn of a new era of entertainment and storytelling. We're learning to put together the pieces and developing the vocabulary, yada, yada, yada. She listened politely to my entire spiel. But when I finished, she crossed her arms over her chest and maintained matter-of-factly, "You're in the fucking game business." Her words jolted me like a hammer to my not-so-sober head. I hardly played games as a kid. I never played a video game all the way through. There always seemed to be something more important to do. I liked sports because there was beauty and physical prowess, but games to me always seemed a distraction. I was definitely not a gamer. I sighed, sinking into the plush seats, a weight suddenly off my shoulders. "I'm in the game business," I confessed to myself as much as to Tony. I had joined Crystal with a vision of taking the company to a new level of interactive cinematic entertainment, but the prospects for achieving that had evaporated months earlier. Cutting back the company would have meant confronting what I had already realized but couldn't admit. Crystal was going to be a video game company, plain and simple, nothing more. My drive said, "Stay and make it work," while my passion prevented me from making the changes needed to do so. The next Monday, I returned to the office and called in my two lieutenants. I explained what they already knew, that Crystal Dynamics was trying to do too much. Given the size of our competitors, we would bleed to death if we didn't change course. "We had to shrink the company," I continued, "to its core strengths. Naturally, they were uncomfortable with my decision, even though they had long been frustrated with my inaction. I asked them to suggest strategies for carrying out the reorganization, and they went off to ponder the options. Next, I met with two key board members and told them my decision. We had skirted this issue more than once without conclusion, but this time there had to be resolution. So I added something further. I was resigning. I would stay long enough to help the company scale back, but I wouldn't run it anymore. What was right for Crystal wasn't right for me. In the end, my two lieutenants, whose groups had fought so bitterly with each other, resigned as well. One of the board members stepped in to lead a scaled-back Crystal focused on producing a few quality games that were distributed by larger players. Crystal was finally sold 2 years later. A small video game company gobbled up by a larger video game company. My departure created turmoil and bitterness for many involved. I felt I had done the unforgivable. I had bailed out of a plane that was still in midair. Yet, when I finally asked myself the question that I encouraged Lenny to ask himself, I could not ignore the chasm between my own passion and what the company needed. Without a grander vision and some prospect of realizing it, Crystal was not a place I could see myself working the rest of my life. That meant I needed to get out. Now. My mind came back to the PetUniverse.com pitch. At least, I thought, I'd started at Crystal with a story and a passion. All I saw on this pitch was greed. I had begun to find aspects of the Stardot game increasingly disturbing. Expedience ruled. Sometimes I wondered if rather than developing tomorrow's business leaders and talent, we weren't merely cloning speculators, hack businessmen and women who arbitraged their drive for a quick hit and who believed that if you're rich, you're right. Heaven help us if these businesses actually have to be operated on a bottom-line basis for the long run. I retreated to my home and checked my messages. After the kind of morning I had, I felt compelled to email Lenny. The deferred life, drive, then passion. Who wants that? Email to Lenny from Randy. Subject, ask it again. Lenny, you completely missed the point of my question. It's not about doing the same job for life. It's about what things you would consider worth doing today if it were your last day. Don't confuse drive and passion. Drive pushes you forward. It's a duty, an obligation. Passion pulls you. It's the sense of connection you feel when the work you do expresses who you are. Only passion will get you through the tough times. As I tell the MBA classes I sometimes address, it's the romance, not the finance, that makes business worth pursuing. You need something in funerals.com that by itself will inspire you and others with you to prevail, no matter what adversity arises. In my experience, the promise or hope of money by itself won't do. Ask yourself the question again. Best are. Chapter 6. The Big Idea. The next morning, I headed towards San Jose for a board meeting. Traveling south on Highway 280 offers none of the gleaming lakes and plush hills that texture the landscape leading to San Francisco. After a brief stretch of road flanked by Stanford's rolling open spaces, grazed by meandering cows, and spotted with giant radio telescope dishes, sprawl displaces the more bucolic scenery. First, suburbia, with its housing developments and strip malls. Then, block after block, crammed with one- and two-story buildings whose fronts are stamped with a veneer of business respectability, but whose three other sides drop the pretense. Tilt-ups, built in a hurry to house wave after wave of new industries. These generic cubes have replaced the boundless acres of cherry, plum, and apricot orchards. This is the Silicon in Silicon Valley, the place where the Fairchilds, Intels, and their progeny were born. Microprocessing plants, chip fabs, clean rooms full of drab bunny suits. This is the place. Like a ghetto that takes on the face of each new wave of immigrants, this part of the valley has, in turn, sheltered the chip, computer, software, and now internet hopefuls. In the future, anthropologists will be able to identify each generation of the valley's industries by sifting through the flotsam and jetsam of endless remodels. A sudden rash of competitors marks each industry cycle. Then the industry peaks and consolidates into a handful of winners. In no time, another wave of wannabe industry builders moves in and fills the vacancies. It's recycling, valley style. I made haste to the offices of TiVo, a high flyer with a big idea, attracting a lot of attention with its promise of changing the entertainment world. The conference room hummed with activity this morning. Various VCs and industry leaders in their denim and khaki finery milled and munched pastries and bagels, clustered in twos and threes. Meanwhile, the management team welcomed arriving board members. Mike Ramsey, CEO and one half of the founding team, was dressed in the stylish L.A. banded collar, pleated slacks look. In his late 40s, Mike's dignified gray is unusual in startups these days. He is an experienced leader, poised and polished, and always appreciative of the people who work with him. His sidekick and co-founder, Jim Barton, on the cusp of 40 and dressed in jeans and a button-down shirt, looks like he grew up on the range. A no-nonsense technologist, he always gives it to you straight. The rest of the executive team are tired somewhere along the Mike-Jim continuum, excuse themselves from the room periodically to deal with whatever momentary emergency required their attention. The finely tailored director from New York, in a blue suit and a white shirt that Lenny would have appreciated, stood a little off to the side, pouring himself another cup of coffee and adding a generous splash of milk. The room was decorated, if that's the right word to use, in the mode of valley professional, stark, functional, disdaining extravagance. A wood conference table for a dozen or more dominated the space. A sleek black box the size of a large laptop computer carefully perched atop a television set, somewhat inconspicuously, in the far corner. Except for the parking lot, where the shiny, late-model luxury cars attested to many early wins, it was hard to tell that the assembled group comprised some of the Valley's most prominent dealmakers and game-changers. In these early-stage businesses, where progress is measured in minutes, monthly board meetings are the norm. At this moment, TiVo was only 2 years old, and it had already raised more than $100 million, attracting an illustrious group of investment partners, including Sony, AOL, Disney, DirecTV, Philips, CBS, NBC, Liberty Media, TV Guide, Showtime, and Quantum. It had launched a world-class product and service, and it had assembled a stellar team. Now TiVo was on the verge of what most founders think of as heaven. It was about to go public. Looking around the room, though, I would say exhaustion trumped elation. And unlike Lenny and other wannabes like him, these guys viewed an IPO as a means, not an end, as a financial pit stop, a chance to refuel for the long, very long road ahead. TiVo had attracted such high-profile support because of its unusual potential, because of the power of the idea and the promise of fundamental change. I had first heard of the company in the autumn of 1997 when Stuart Alsop, a Silicon Valley pundit, columnist, and venture capitalist partner in New Enterprise Associates, called me about the initial idea. He and Jeff Yang, a prominent venture capitalist then at Institutional Venture Partners and now at Redpoint Ventures, were seeding a startup called Teleworld, TiVo's first incarnation. A few days later, I headed over to the Konditorei to listen to the founder's pitch. Mike Ramsey was a distinguished executive from Silicon Graphics, where he had run a large piece of business, and Jim Barton was a standout engineering wizard who had also come from SGI. Among those who pitched me, they were unusual in their maturity and accomplishments. SGI had been involved with Time Warner Cable's video-on-demand trials in Orlando, Florida, an ambitious attempt to cost-effectively deliver to home viewers a vast library of movies they could watch at their convenience. Those trials had been a bust, but Mike and Jim wanted to apply the lessons learned to a new venture. Their Teleworld idea was to sell a new kind of hardware, a home server, that not only digitally stored incoming electronic information, including audio and video content, but also linked the gamut of digital devices rapidly becoming commonplace in the home. Computers, PDAs, and internet appliances. Concerned that they might be ahead of the market and the customers would be slow to appreciate the ultimate value of their product, Mike and Jim planned to jumpstart the business by giving customers the ability to digitize and store several hours of television programming in a set-top box. Their initial product would be, in effect, a souped-up VCR with a clever programming guide. Because of the costly electronic storage requirements, it would carry a hefty price tag. Their strategy made me cringe. Working at companies like Go and WebTV convinced me there is no margin in the consumer hardware business. It requires an enormous investment, demands massive distribution, and scales slowly. I believe the value of consumer hardware could be derived only from the services it delivered to the consumer and industry partners, in this case, advertisers, programmers, and networks. The business model inherent in such a strategy, though, is uncertain. If you price the hardware high enough to generate acceptable margins, your product's retail price is too costly to quickly develop the volume of users needed to enable a robust service business. On the other hand, unlike with internet services and software where there is no or nominal marginal expense for each new user, the cost of subsidizing these pricey boxes to make them affordable in order to accelerate adoption could break the bank. Mike and Jim talked about selling hundreds of thousands of set-top boxes, but that wouldn't build a large enough audience for service providers and advertisers. They would have to sell millions of units, and quickly. If they focused on the boxes, I told them, your legacy may be that you sowed the seeds of a huge market, which the consumer electronics giants and service providers ultimately reaped. Pioneer new territory, I cautioned, but don't end up with arrows in your backs. What a buzzkill I was. They were gracious and thanked me for my candor. As we parted, I couldn't imagine how they would succeed in the hardware business they envisioned, and I never expected to hear from them again. Entrepreneurs, in my experience, don't like to be told they're wrong. It isn't in their dispositions to sit and listen to that type of critique. That's why many ideas in this valley happen against all common sense. It's good when entrepreneurs are a little bit deaf and blind, but if they're completely deaf and completely blind, and many are, they're unlikely to learn enough from the market and their advisors to make their vision a reality. To my surprise, Mike called me back a week later, and I agreed to meet again. He and Jim hadn't taken my advice wholesale, but they had carefully considered it and revised their plans where they thought their ideas could be improved. Their new idea, which ultimately became TiVo, was much, much bigger. In essence, they had evolved the business from a hardware-based model to a service-based strategy. The gist of their big idea was what they called personalized television. Using the box and its ability to record programming, they now proposed to build a service that would give viewers complete individualized control over what they viewed on television and when they viewed it. They would price the box lower to foster sales and higher volumes, leaping into a financial no man's land in a gamble that they could assemble a marketable audience in time for the service revenues to kick in and more than compensate for their losses on the boxes. How would they make money when each box was priced below cost? Volume. That is, a volume of viewers sufficient to fund a money-making service based on subscriptions, advertising, and commerce. The mix among those revenue sources and the balance between how much would come from consumers and how much would come from industry partners would be determined later. Eventually, they believed that the standalone hardware and its expense would disappear as televisions and other set-top boxes provided the power and digital storage necessary for personalized television. Then TiVo would be a service provider only, with a much stronger financial model. I listened to their new idea and realized that if they succeeded, the grid between television programming and network time slots would be broken. If the viewer was watching a show that had been time-shifted, commercials would no longer have a captive audience. The viewer could simply skip forward at will. He could watch a show broadcast Sunday mornings during weekday primetime, and vice versa. Advertisers who paid top dollar for primetime audiences might or might not reach those audiences anymore. With TiVo's box, your time was primetime, anytime you watched. Control would move from the broadcast networks to every single member of the audience. Television would never be the same. There was more, I realized, because TiVo would be interactive. The service required a phone connection for the data transmission and customer support, which created a direct path to and from every single viewer. Viewers would be able to communicate with the TiVo service for a myriad of purposes. At first, to express opinions about shows or organize their own lineups, and eventually, if anyone cared, to buy the blouse right off an actress's back. As you watched television, your box would learn what you liked and, if you wanted, automatically find and save it for you. Eventually, you would receive only relevant advertising and marketing messages targeted to your interests. These services depended on sophisticated technology at the back end, but users wouldn't have to know about any of that. It would all be transparent to them. This was a chance to find value in increasingly segmented audiences. An audience of 2 million might be worth more than an audience of 20 million because of what was known about those 2 million people. Better to send an advertisement for Corvettes to a small audience composed entirely of affluent single males than to a large audience composed mostly of working couples with three kids. Best of all, the audience's personal profiles would be private and secure, allowing viewers to decide when and if they wanted to share personal information. The possibilities raised by this vision were enormous, but many pieces would need to come together to make it work, and many incumbents in the television business might see the impending changes as a threat and resist. As I sat in the Konditerai during the second meeting with Mike and Jim, my mind was spinning through the possibilities. I thought, these guys don't need 20 million. They need 200 million, just for starters. This effort would require experienced leaders, a management team capable of forging a complex set of relationships among advertisers, programmers, broadcasters, and content creators. The team risked making enemies of those behemoths unless they could convince them to join the movement. The incumbents could not be ignored because their roles in the future of television entertainment would remain critical. It all depended on content, and somebody somewhere would have to pay for it. It was unlikely that everything would become pay-per-view, and so the role of advertisers would remain powerful. And then both content and advertising would still need to be distributed by networks and broadcasters. This would require shuttle diplomacy, not simply technological prowess. I couldn't resist their big idea. When they invited me to help make it a reality, I didn't hesitate. Eventually, I joined the executive committee of the board of directors. For 2 years, Mike and Jim tirelessly evangelized the industry players, and after their initial alarm, the leaders were intrigued enough by this big idea to offer support. Now TiVo needed to raise a large sum in order to finance its race to roll out the technology and build an audience. It was time to go to Wall Street. We were at today's board meeting to bless this next step, the IPO. Much of the meeting focused on Byzantine legal issues regarding an initial offering. The lawyers from Cooley Godward, a venerable Valley firm, reviewed the status of the red herring, an initial filing with the SEC. Most of us had heard the litany before, so the lawyers balanced doing their duty with being succinct. They discussed the accounting issues regarding stock options granted to employees. The SEC claimed that some of these were priced below market. If the federal watchdog only knew how hit or miss these ventures were, how sudden the surge forward toward an IPO could come on, they might better understand why almost every company in the Valley regularly faced the cheap stock issue. The lawyers cautioned us against discussing the IPO during the quiet period, another faux pas, according to the SEC, because it can be misconstrued as prematurely promoting the stock. We were reminded, as was common practice with IPOs, that the company's employees and investors would be locked up or forbidden from trading in TiVo stock for 180 days, thus ensuring a more manageable stock price in the 6 months following the offering. Finally, the SEC wanted clarification about my title, virtual CEO, and asked that it be changed to avoid misleading the market. Old dogs don't take well to new tricks, and it was once again obvious why the new economy germinated in the Valley. The board cautioned the management team to avoid becoming too distracted or euphoric about the IPO. Not even founders and management committed for the long haul can avoid some preoccupation with the IPO's life-changing potential. The first day of trading can be mesmerizing for those who have worked tirelessly to build the company. To these entrepreneurs, the IPO is proof they aren't lunatics. They are finally able, at least temporarily, to stop protesting to family and friends that this work will make a difference and that they are sane despite having sacrificed everything for this chance. After the IPO, riding the share price around the curves and corners can make you dizzy. Good management must remind people constantly to ignore the jerking and lurching of the market and focus on the horizon. Stay calm. TiVo had a chance to change the status quo for the better, with potential we could only guess at. Sure, the market and business model were not yet proven. The incumbents could stonewall, and competitors, large and small, might hijack the opportunity. But Mike and Jim were up for the challenge. Smart, experienced, flexible, capable of learning on the fly, and willing to do what it would take to win. They did not waste any time speaking to me about exit strategies. Personalized television would be their legacy. I returned home mid-afternoon, changed into shorts and a t-shirt, opened the doors to the hills, let the dogs mosey a bit, and spent an hour or so working out in the downstairs exercise room, come office, come dog dorm. I lifted a few weights and put in some time on the treadmill while taking and responding to phone messages, my own recipe for multitasking. Then I checked emails. Surprise, surprise. Lenny had not disappeared. Tucked in the middle of several messages was one marked, urgent. Email. To Randy. From Lenny. Subject. Pay dirt. Hey, Randy. Great news. Frank called and wants us to present next Monday morning at his partners meeting. This is the break we've been waiting for. I don't know what you said, but thank you. One little glitch. Allison, my partner, got a job offer she's considering taking. I think she's losing patience, just when all our work is beginning to pay off. The job offer is from some HMO. She'd be involved with developing a strategy for supporting members on the net, though it doesn't compare to funerals.com. She's agreed to come with me for the presentation Monday, but she's wavering between funerals.com and the new job. Would you be willing to get together with us after we meet with Frank and his partners? If Allison had the chance to talk with you, I have a feeling she'd be back on board, especially if the meeting with Frank goes well. I realize you don't know her, so I'm forwarding her email along with another revised version of the business plan. I've given a lot of thought to your question, but right now I need to focus on the meeting. I can almost smell the money. Finally, I can't believe it. Lenny. I let out a sigh. Stranger things have happened. As any other good VC would do, Frank was sniffing around that big market, and Lenny was his only play for the moment. I'm sure that as soon as he heard from Frank, Lenny eagerly set aside all the issues I was raising. Why bother with some loopy, metaphysical question if you're going to raise the money anyway and get rich in the process? Allison's indecision posed a critical challenge to Lenny. If he lost her, it would be a serious blow to his chances. I opened her email. To Lenny, from Allison. Subject: Regarding California, here we come. Hi, Lenny. All right, I'll go. I don't want you to fail, even if I'm not associated with funerals.com in the long run. You have labored so hard for this. Whatever happens, I hope it works out for you. You deserve it. But please understand, even if I go with you, I'm not committing. I'm having trouble seeing in funerals.com now the idea that attracted me to it in the first place. When we started talking about it and planning for it, when you and your family were having such a hard time with your dad's death, we saw it as a way to help people who are struggling with loss and grief. It wasn't just selling cheaper caskets. As you say, that's a good place to start, and I understand why investors will focus on the economics of the business. But personally, I'm not interested in simply being an e-tailer. I'll help as much as I can, but I'm not there yet. I have to let the HMO know in 10 days. Later, Al. It wouldn't have surprised me if Lenny's partner bailed out because she received a better offer, something concrete in contrast to the hazard inherent in a startup. But I hadn't considered that she might be at odds with Lenny's lifeless mission, or that their original idea might have been more compassionate and compelling than Lenny now let on. I couldn't tell from the little Allison said, but helping people who are struggling with loss and grief seemed more intriguing to me than flogging cheaper caskets. A bigger idea. I was already beginning to like this Allison. The chance to work on a big idea is a powerful reason for people to be passionate and committed. The big idea is the glue that connects with their passion and binds them to the mission of the organization. For people to be great, to accomplish the impossible, they need inspiration more than financial incentive. Lenny appeared to be jettisoning his founding vision for some misguided notion of what success demanded. He was trying to reduce funerals.com to an equation, a formula, a model. Impatience wasn't Allison's problem. Finding something in funerals.com to care about was. Her ambivalence and Lenny's focus on the formula over the mission brought to mind my experience at Apple, specifically one of the most pivotal negotiations I was involved in there, which was reported only recently for the first time. Apple's big idea had been computing for the rest of us. But the company increasingly found itself hostage to the margins and quarterly results generated by its business model, which was built around premium hardware. Its share of the PC business was limited as it became addicted to selling computers at much higher margins and prices than its competitors. Its intuitive, friendly interface was the justification for those margins, but that business model and Apple's position were threatened by none other than Microsoft. In 1986, we had all seen Windows 1.0, and while it posed no threat to the Macintosh operating environment at the time, we understood what it meant. Microsoft's toe, even its whole foot, was in the water. At some point, it would develop a product that was good enough. Then the competition would look sufficiently like Apple to erode Apple's margins and back it into a corner of its own making, with declining share and profit. Along with many others inside Apple, I was a strong proponent of licensing the Macintosh operating system in order to preempt Microsoft in setting the standard for user-friendly computing. After all, it was Apple's birthright, its overriding mission. It would mean cannibalizing our own model, sacrificing margins for volume and market share, but it seemed better than circling the wagons and defending an ever-declining piece of the PC business. Apple's general counsel, my boss, asked me to develop a licensing plan for the Mac operating system, with safeguards for protecting Apple's basic interests. In a first step toward a new strategy, a colleague and I were assigned to negotiate a license of the Mac look and feel to Apollo Computer in Massachusetts, one of the leading manufacturers of workstations at the time. My partner, Mike Homer, was a prodigy in Apple's marketing organization. He was facile with technology and had a flair for sales and marketing. Later, he would play a crucial role at Netscape. The two of us tag-teamed the negotiations with Apollo for months, flying back and forth across the country, coordinating with the mothership in Cupertino, and eventually reaching an agreement. Now, all we needed was the signature of John Sculley. Mike brought the agreement to Apple's executive team, fully expecting it to be signed and the company to announce it was finally licensing the operating system to others. Negotiating the deal had been a deliberate process, the outcome of a calculated strategy for which there had been something of a consensus. What happened instead, typical Apple management style at the time, was that pent-up reservations about our margins and business model surfaced and carried the day. Sculley caved in at the 11th hour. We barely managed to catch the Apollo people en route to Cupertino for the final signing and celebration at Logan Airport in Boston. The news was more than an embarrassment. Arguably, refusing to license the Mac OS was a fatal mistake for Sculley and his management team, and a critical misstep for Apple. No one could know what might have happened if Apple had gone ahead with the agreement and with licensing the operating system to other manufacturers. Sculley's Apple subordinated the company's big idea to the business model. That model was not the essence of Apple. It was simply that moment's best means of realizing value from the big idea. The business model can and should change over time as the world changes. Ultimately, when the big idea was lost, the market and Apple's employees could no longer find a reason to support Apple's business. Their fanaticism faded to ambivalence. I was curious about whether Lenny was following the example of Sculley's Apple even before he had been able to start the business. Was he selling the business model rather than the big idea, whatever it was, that had attracted Allison and him to Funerals.com in the beginning? Business conditions are forever changing. You need to reconsider your strategies and business models constantly and adjust them where necessary. But the big idea that your company pursues is the touchstone for those refinements. Ditching the big idea in order to deal with business exigencies leaves you without a compass. I always advise companies to define their business in terms of where it's going, what it's becoming, not simply where it is. Set the compass, then work hard to clear a path, knowing that you may meander as you stumble upon obstacles, but will always keep heading toward the same coordinates. I sent Lenny an email confirming that I looked forward to meeting him and Allison next Monday, and went outside to pester the dogs. Chapter 7. The Bottom Line. One mega double decaf non-fat latte, please. Oh, a why bother? Connie winked at me. You do live dangerously. I handed her my $2.49 and headed to my usual table, just outside the door. Why bother, I thought, with a drink that has so little soul, that looks like the real thing, but it has lost its punch through some tedious processing. The portions keep getting larger, but the zest has been replaced with a faint trace. Perhaps it was time to return to drip. I took a sip of hot foam and hoped for something more satisfying from Lenny's revised business plan, version 8.0, which I put on the table in front of me. I'd arrived early to spend a few minutes reviewing it. If Lenny's claims were true, this version answered all the nagging questions and set funerals.com on the path to greatness. I glanced through it. He had reworked the market and share estimates to more aggressively dominate a slightly smaller market. He'd added a section explaining how he'd find prospects, primarily through referrals from healthcare professionals who work with the dying and survivors. He'd even prepared an organizational chart with himself as CEO and Allison as VP of marketing. The rest of the boxes were blank. Including Allison in the plan was Lenny's wishful thinking. All in all, he had made a few tactical improvements, but it was still better, faster, cheaper caskets. Lenny was prepared to try, it seemed, to squeak by in his presentation. I wondered how Frank and his partners would react. I looked up to see Lenny and a woman who had to be Allison walking across the parking lot. Far taller than Lenny, Allison seemed to take one stride to his two. Lenny was gesticulating, nearly hopping with excitement as they approached. Allison smiled as Lenny pointed me out, said something, and laughed. An inside joke I'd have to suss out later. The VC meeting must have gone well. Randy, it couldn't have gone better, Lenny bellowed when he was nearly upon me. As he reached for my hand, he added, Frank was great. He pulled for us. I feel really good about this. No arm lock this time. Instead, he patted me on the shoulder. We were buddies now. Thanks to you, Randy. Yeah, right. He introduced Allison as his partner. You two want something to drink, he said. On me? I pointed at the half-full cup before me. Don't get me started again, I thought. Lenny went off to the counter. Allison and I shook hands, and she pulled a white plastic chair from the adjoining table and sat down. So it went pretty well? I asked her, trying to conceal my concerns. I think so, she said. Lenny's very pleased. If there was a hint of doubt in her voice, she was carefully masking it. Dressed conservatively in a dark suit and white blouse with a navy scarf, Allison kept her hair pulled back modestly from her face. She and Lenny made a matched pair, but the similarity ended there. With her height and bearing, Allison's quiet confidence was the antithesis of Lenny's edgy energy. I would be surprised, I thought, if she were the spin machine he was. At the moment, in her look and manner, she seemed reserved, or perhaps just reflective, She probably hadn't known what to expect when she agreed to accompany Lenny for this meeting. "What happened?" I persisted. "What did Frank say?" "He seemed very positive when he walked us out at the end. He promised he'd be in touch." "Well, he's a man of his word, but his graciousness did not tell me anything." I watched Lenny at the counter, entertaining Connie. He was no doubt regaling her with news of the meeting and prophesizing a big check. She was practicing her active listening. Notwithstanding their happy smiles, both Lenny and Allison actually looked spent from their morning. As these events go, they were probably only one of several auditioning teams on the roster at Frank's firm. The partners usually sit around an enormous wooden conference table equipped with every space-age audio-video device known to man. Of course, no one ever knows how to use it all, and no matter how technically distinguished the founders, it always seems an eternity as the last-minute technical glitches are wrestled to the ground before the pyrotechnics begin. Eager young assistants enter at will, passing scraps of paper to partners. Partners leave, and new ones enter. As a presenter, you hope all this coming and going involves intrigues of dramatic proportions. But it usually means something more innocent. A partner's new Mercedes has arrived, or arrangements need to be made to pick up the kids after school. In spite of the informality, the whole experience leaves many presenting teams feeling stripped naked. Sometimes a team never even proceeds beyond the first slide as the inquisitors hurl unanswerable or painfully sensitive questions that cut through dreams with surgical precision. I have observed the ritual many times. Every day, in the lobbies of Sand Hill Road, scores of founders sit nervously, waiting their turn with the dentist. "Sounds like you sailed through without a problem," I probed. "Oh, I wouldn't say that," she replied. "I don't know how these things are supposed to go, but there were lots of tough questions. They seemed tough to me, anyway. I'm not sure we answered them to their satisfaction. But Lenny seems to think so." Lenny returned with Allison's black tea and his coffee. I changed the topic. "Lenny never told me," I said to Allison, "how you and he got together on funerals.com. She smiled, more relaxed with this tack. "We've known each other most of our lives." They played together as kids. She'd been born in Boston, but her parents moved shortly after to the Midwest. Times were hard, so she spent summers with her grandmother, who lived next door to Lenny and his family. Somehow Lenny and she became fast friends. She was a few years older than he. "We lost touch when I stopped visiting," she said. "We only ran into each other again 8 or 10 months ago." Allison, back in Boston for her grandmother's 75th birthday, learned that Lenny's father had died suddenly that week. The next day, she attended the funeral and paid her respects. Afterwards, she and Lenny fell into talking about the funeral and the complications caused by the fact that Jack's children, not to mention his many brothers and sisters, were scattered around the country. Lenny and Allison's discussions turned into exchanges of lengthy emails and then face-to-face meetings as they laid the plans for funerals.com. Allison, who held a master's degree in social work and had worked her way up over the course of 8 years to head of marketing for chain of funeral homes, knew the industry. Her knowledge and Lenny's fascination with the internet formed the impetus for funerals.com. "Lenny's a salesman here," she added. "He's had to carry all the water with the business plans and presentations." I asked Lenny, "Did you give them your funeral home pitch today?" He shook his head a bit sheepishly. "I told him I'd walk out if he did," Allison laughed. "Tell me what you thought about the meeting, Lenny," I said. "Meeting with you and working through your questions," he began, "was like practicing for today's presentation, the main event. All the detail about markets and distribution went over just great." He went on to recount the meeting blow by blow as Allison sat quietly, He had talked through his slides. There were many questions, he said, about the market and about how the funeral business worked. They answered all the questions, and Allison and her knowledge of the business were invaluable. Frank was extremely helpful. He made sure key points were brought out and understood. Like Allison, Lenny put great stock in Frank's manner and words as he politely walked them out. It was a mystery to me. The way Lenny described it, the presentation sounded like a love fest. I began to wonder what Frank and his partners were putting in their coffee. This didn't sound like a run-of-the-mill VC presentation. Nor did it sound like the meeting Allison had started to describe moments earlier. "And the tough questions?" I wondered. "There were some tough questions now and then," Lenny said, "but nothing we couldn't handle. I think everybody was happy with the answers." Allison's brow creased. "Frank was supportive," she finally offered, "and they do seem genuinely interested in the market. I don't think they hear many ideas like this. I mean, I can't imagine too many hot, young internet entrepreneurs are dying to work in the funeral business." Lenny laughed. "But Lenny, I thought Phil asked some questions we didn't fully address," she said. She watched Lenny, knowing that she was contradicting him. "I knew Phil, one of Frank's partners. He's a wiry, intense former academic, noted for wearing suspenders and bow ties. He had taught engineering at Stanford before becoming a VC. I think we handled them all right," Lenny defended. "But I was watching him closely while you were talking, and I don't know if he was." "Yeah, but Frank covered for us," Lenny cut her off. "He'll take care of it. He was very upbeat at the end." "What did Phil say?" I asked, looking at Allison this time. "Well," she said, "he wanted to know how many people were going to buy our products online. He was skeptical that people would be so deliberate at such an emotional time. Would they shop around? Would they use the web to research their choices? Lots of questions like that." She stopped for a moment. "I don't think he was satisfied. Phil stopped taking notes and started doodling long before Lenny was done," she remembered. This sounded more like the meetings I was familiar with. "But Phil was the only skeptic," Lenny said, out of the whole group. I told him I doubted that. Most VCs require unanimity among partners before they move forward with a deal. They won't invest unless they all agree, or close to it. In these meetings, there's usually proponents for each idea. Frank brought Lenny in, so he was probably playing the role of good cop. He made sure all the points in favor of the idea got presented, were understood, and were discussed. VCs want to run prospects through their paces, but it makes no sense to crucify them. So there's a good cop, and often some other partner will assume the role of bad cop to ask the hard questions and probe the issues that surfaced in earlier discussions among the partners. Sounds like Phil was the bad cop this morning. He may have been the one asking the tough questions, but he was probably speaking for all the partners, even Frank, in his skepticism. "You may have been so busy presenting that you missed the signals," I suggested to Lenny. Lenny looked at me for a moment, miffed. "You had to be there," he finally said. And I wasn't. True enough. "Phil was most worried," Allison went on, "that if we pioneer the market, some big funeral chain, like my company, would see the opportunity and decide to compete with us. They have the size and money we don't have, and their network of local funeral homes is a big advantage." "But they're slow and stuck in their old business model," Lenny pushed back. "They have to support all that brick and mortar with high margins. That's what I said in the meeting. They won't cannibalize their current business. Besides, when the brick and mortar guys finally get it and decide to go click and mortar, they'll buy us. Maybe they have money now, but they're not hip to the internet." He glanced at me to see if he registered any points. "I'm not sure," I started to say. "How smart do you have to be," Allison jumped in, "to sell caskets cheap on the internet? Come on, Lenny." At first, embarrassed, Lenny then glared at her. His entire face glowed red. She looked at me again and made some sort of decision to go ahead. "Selling cheap caskets isn't what we started out to do," she confessed. "Wait a minute. We'll get to all that later," Lenny cut in sharply. "Once we land the money and funerals.com